Okay, I think we can begin. 2 weeks ago, we were discussing Poincaré series. These are to be viewed as generalizations of Eisenstein series, and I started by describing a little bit of the classical theory. So Poincaré series for SL2Z. And these are defined as follows. So we can fix K, which is a natural number. And for each r, which is an integer, we'll define gr of z to be, well, I'll write it in this kind of naive fashion first, c sub plus d to the minus k, e to the 2 pi I r az plus b over cz plus d, where you go over all coprime integers c and d, and for each c and d chosen, which are coprime, you would then find a and b such that ad minus bc is equal to 1. Any such a and b will do, this being independent of the choice, and I left that as an exercise for you. I'm not putting in the k in here, although I should, but it just clutters up the notation. The cluttered up notation can be found in Rankin's book. Rankin's book on modular forms, where much of this version is done. No, r is an integer. Any integer, yeah. So, and the amazing thing is this formula of Peterson. So, yeah, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Okay, r is, has to be positive. Okay, yeah, you're okay. So, okay, r is positive integer. Well, non-negative, yeah. So positive integer. Now, for z equal, so for r equal to 0, this is like the classical Eisenstein series, the modular form. So let me make that remark. Yeah, of course, yeah. So k, yeah. Let me give the idea, okay, and then we'll quibble about convergence questions later. So for r equals 0, we retrieve the classical modular form of weight k. The Eisenstein series. Now, the reason I insist on saying this kind of description for it is because, as you know, we have other Eisenstein series like EZS, and so clearly there's going to be a version of EZS corresponding to GR of Z as well, so which is going to be significant. Now I was rushed the last time, and I think I messed up a few things, so I'd like to correct that now. So, as you know, the Fourier expansion of EK of Z is something very elementary. It's carried out in the last chapter of Sayre's course in arithmetic and involves divisor functions. So you can actually write down the Fourier coefficients of EK of Z explicitly. And the amazing thing is that for each of these GR of Zs, you can also write down the Fourier expansion explicitly involving Clustermann sums. And this was the this was the point. The first point is the formula of Peterson. That the Peterson inner product of any cusp form f with gr of z picks out the rth Fourier coefficient of f. Where is the Fourier expansion of the cusp form. Now, once we have this result that the inner product of f with gr picks out the cusp form, it automatically follows that every cusp form can be written as a linear combination of Poincaré series. So this is Poincaré series here. Okay. I should have mentioned, I did this last time, that this thing can be, of course, written in a much more invariant fashion. You know, gamma is SL2C. And you have the stabilizer at infinity. And from this definition, it's clear that GR of gamma z is gamma invariant. And in general, we have oh, yeah, thank you. J of gamma of C. Thank you. I wrote that last time correctly, but okay. J of gamma of C. Okay. Thanks. Okay, now, if you actually write out the definition of the inner product as an integral over the fundamental domain. So writing out the inner product as an integral over the fundamental domain of, you know, f of z, gr of z bar dx dy by y squared. If you write it like so, and plug in the definition of gr of z as a series and interchange and do the unfolding of the integral, the unfolding of the integral also called the Rankine-Selberg trick leads to an explicit formula. What I find fascinating, remarkable explicit formula, for this inner product. And what is it? Well, you just do the obvious and you end up getting the following formula. So let's say gr of z summation g sub r n e to the 2 pi I z to infinity, then g r n is equal to n over r to the power k minus 1 over 2 delta r n plus pi summation c going from 1 to infinity s r n c divided by C, J sub K minus 1, 4 pi root R n over C, where delta Rn is a Kronecker delta function. So it's 0 or 1. So it's usually 0 unless r equals n, in which case it's 1. The SRnC is the Clustermann sum. Where A is chosen to be the multiplicative inverse of D mod C. So this is a Clustermann sum. And the Bessel function I gave last time, but give it again. Function is, well, there are various ways of writing this. It's given by a contour integral unit circle t to the minus k minus 1 z over 2 t minus 1 over t dt. So this is really an amazing formula for the Fourier coefficient of the Poincaré series. And on this formula has been based all the advances for the last quarter century in analytic number theory. All of the spectacular advances are based on this one significant formula and the appearance of the Clustermann sum. Now today's lecture and probably next week's lecture, I'll try and outline how it influences analytic number theory. Well, the connection. No, no. Yes, that particular thing, when you do the unfolding, you get an expression for the inner product, correct? No, no, not that, of course. When I plug in GR of Z, you know, if I plug in, I shouldn't have used this notation, but if I plug in for FGS of Z, okay, I will pull out the, does that make sense? The cusp forms, yeah. Doesn't that make sense? I used bad notation, but let me just say, so observe. I mean, this inner product, so if I had written GN of Z here, okay, GN of Z, I think I messed up my note subscripts and notation. All I'm doing is taking a Poincaré series and using that formula. So this particular calculation here is independent of this formula. I'm not going to. Okay, so when I calculate the inner product, I get.
I think what it meant is that formula, free expansion just comes from the free expansion formula, just integrated from 0 to 1, expanding in terms of the inner product formula.
Yeah, that's right.
Free expansion has nothing to do with the inner product formula.
Yeah. So okay, that's right. So so we start with this formula. This particular expression, and write down the formula for the Fourier coefficient, and when you write it down, you get this. Okay. Now I'm going to say that I connected with this. I'm not finished yet. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, it leads to a remarkable explicit formula in the following sense. I mean, okay. So these are, this is just the Fourier coefficient of the of this particular Poincaré shape. Okay, so let's just say, okay, so this is obtained. By a straightforward calculation. And that is obtained by doing that. Okay, so this goes, these two boards go together. This is obtained by a straightforward calculation. Now we put the two observations together. So, since the Poincaré series span the space of cusp forms, this gives us an explicit formula for the Fourier coefficient, for the nth Fourier coefficient of any cusp form. So you first write your cusp form as a linear combination of Poincaré series, and then you use this formula for that purpose. So as an example, I think I mentioned this last time, when k is 12, for the full modular group, these are all cusp forms of weight k, so weight 12, and we know that up to a constant there's only one cusp form, that's the Ramanujan cusp form, and therefore these must be multiples of the Ramanujan cusp form. Which multiples are they? They must be essentially the tau r, the rth Fourier coefficient, times the cusp form. So I think I mentioned special example last time, if I can only find it. Yeah, here it is. So for example, when k equals 12, you get that the Peterson inner product is just 10 factorial times tau of r divided by 4 pi r to the 11, where delta is Ramanujan's cusp form. So that means, in particular, that when we know that if you want to prove the Ramanujan conjecture about estimating Fourier coefficients of cusp forms, it suffices to attack and establish the same estimate for the coefficients of Poincaré series. Okay. So now, in particular, if you're trying to establish that all the Fourier coefficients are n to the O of n to the k minus 1 over 2 plus epsilon, we have the n to the k minus 1 over 2 sitting out here. We may as well assume r is not equal to n. You know, just take one of the, or r is bounded or something. So essentially, the thing to focus on is this. And so this is exactly the thrust of the 1965 paper of Selberg, where he says, now you look at this expression, and you plug in Weyl's estimate for the Clustermann sum, and out pops out O of n to the quarter. So in his 1965 paper, Selberg uses Weyl's estimates for Clustermann sums, that. And obtains the result that GRN is O of n to the k minus 1 over 2 plus 1 quarter plus epsilon. Now, the paper of Selberg is significant for various reasons, the most important being that Selberg considers the problem from a more general angle. So he takes an arbitrary discrete subgroup gamma of SL2R and develops this entire theory in that context. And then you end up getting Clustermann sums, which are not like this, but modifications of this, appropriate generalizations of these Clustermann sums. And he analyzes the estimates for these Clustermann sums and shows that Wey's estimate actually doesn't hold in the full generality that you expected. You're not going to get square root C all the time. So, and basing it on this kind of an analysis, he links the study of these Clustermann sums to a new zeta function and relates the eigenvalue problem and the Ramanujan conjecture, both of these things, to the study of that particular Dirichlet series. So I think that's where I left off last time. Now, that's where I left off last time. So maybe I write down. The main point of Selberg's paper. So Selberg introduces the zeta function ZRNS introduces this zeta function concocted out of the Clustermann sums. And he makes the following conjecture, which is now called the Selberg-Linick conjecture. That the averages of the Clustermann sums O of x to the epsilon for any epsilon positive and uniformly if the GCD of n of R and n is bigger than if x is bigger than the GCD of R and n to the half plus epsilon. So this is the Selberg-Linick conjecture. Selberg arrived at it in this context. And I think Linick arrived at it from the standpoint of the large sieve, the theory of the large sieve. No, I don't know why I write it like that, yeah. It could, yeah, it could happen, yeah. In this case, it doesn't matter, yeah. Oh, I shouldn't have rubbed this off, but anyway, yeah, let me keep this on for a while. Peterson's formula. Okay, I think I can rub this off. So yeah, before I rub this particular thing off, I want to make some comments, but let me make two comments with respect to the Selberg-Linick conjecture. The first comment is that one of the reasons for making that conjecture is that so you can prove the Ramanujan conjecture. That's one motivation for it. And I indicated last time how, assuming this conjecture, you can prove the Ramanujan conjecture. The other motivation for making this conjecture is so you can prove the Selberg's eigenvalue conjecture. So the Selberg-Linick conjecture. Pardon me? That's right. X to the 1/6 is due to Kuznetsov. Okay, that O of it's that sum is O of x to the 1/6 is all that we know. Not really, no. Who did that? No. Yeah, I'm going to come to that, okay? The Selberg-Linick conjecture is, you may be right, I'm not 100% sure. You can do better than a sixth, though. Well, Selberg-Linick will imply the Selberg eigenvalue conjecture and the Ramanujan conjecture. So it's a stronger conjecture than both of the two. So, and then I think there is a bit of analysis that one can do to show that they're almost, actually this is a very strong conjecture. Yeah, I'll check that. The Selberg-Linick conjecture implies Ramanujan conjecture. It implies the Selberg eigenvalue conjecture. And so last time I indicated how this goes. This time I want to indicate how the second part goes. And remember that according to the Langlands philosophy, the Ramanujan conjecture at infinity is really the Selberg eigenvalue conjecture. Therefore, there's a conceptual similarity between the two conjectures. And based on this conceptual similarity, one expects that every time there's an improvement on one side, that there should be an improvement on the other side. Now, this philosophy, as you will see, is not justified even in the full modular case, because later on I'll give you a very simple argument based on advanced calculus, Stokes theorem, that shows the Selberg eigenvalue conjecture is true for the full modular group. But we don't have the Ramanujan conjecture for the full modular group. We don't know estimates for Fourier coefficients of mass forms for the full modular group. So, you know, the theme does not actually carry over. Okay, before I rub this off, I want to specialize, put F equals GT in Peter's formula. So, what I call, or what's usually called, quasi-orthogonality. Of Fourier coefficients. Of Poincaré series. So in Peterson's formula, put F equals GT, G sub T, so that you get this formula G sub TR with the old notation. And then I can just say that this thing is equal to times R over T here, delta RT pi STR. As you can see, I wasn't very careful with my notation, otherwise I would have had this perfect. And so you end up getting that this inner product GT with GR is equal to this, which shows us how are we supposed to look at this formula. Well, this thing simplifies. It comes out to be something times RT to the power k minus 1 over 2 times this thing. Now, delta RT is 1 or 0 according as R and T are equal or not. So this is 1 or 0. And then you have this error term. So if you think of the error term as being small, like it's supposed to be, you can see that the GTR, the Poincaré series, come out to be very close to an orthonormal basis. They're not quite an orthonormal basis, but they're pretty close to being such. Pardon me?
The negative
of that? Oh, yeah, yeah. Wait a minute. Something is wrong, funny. Yeah, you're right. Minus. No, you're right. It is. It is minus, yeah. Yeah. The main point is that you pick up a 1 or 0, and then you pick up an error term. So now if... So in the special case, of the space of cusp forms, let's say on gamma, let's choose an orthonormal basis, orthonormal with respect to the Peterson inner product, and write your Poincaré series as a linear combination of this orthonormal basis. Pardon me? That's V, yeah, sorry. Well, if I don't want to put, just put subscript I here. And then now compute, so here, I mean, this is just linear algebra. Now compute the rth Fourier coefficient of both sides. So we know what the rth Fourier coefficient is from the Peterson, this formula. And from this side, we know, we just write down the rth Fourier coefficient. So you end up getting the GTR equals summation I going from 1 to V. Well, this gamma K minus 1 stuff is irrelevant. I'm sorry, there's an R in here. Over to, thank you. So let me write this down as a theorem. I think this is an important theorem. So gamma k minus 1 over 4 pi rt to the power k minus 1 over 2. I may have had this. I think this is supposed to, forget these constants. That's not the important part, but the important part is the orthogonality that kind of comes out. Which tells us that the Fourier coefficients, okay, are quasi-orthogonal in the sense that if R is not equal to T, this term drops out and you get this error term, which you expect to be small on the Selberg conjecture. And whereas, because this is the main, this is the, you know, it contributes to the main term. So this, if delta, if R equals T, this is going to be 1, and this whole sum is going to be asymptotic to something like r to the k minus 1. It's going to be large. And if it's r and t are not equal, this thing is going to be r to the k minus 1 over 2 plus epsilon. It's going to be small, because this is supposed to be a small thing. So the Selberg-Linick conjecture also implies that this whole thing is extremely negligible. And so we get this quasi-orthogonality principle. Pardon me? No, I didn't put one in, but you can if you want. You don't. I didn't put one in. It's not. It's just the way I wrote things down. If you wanted to make it look nicely like an orthogonality statement, I should have put the complex conjugation somewhere, but it's not. I could have written FG, you know. This is for the full modular group, but it also works for any congruent subgroup. In fact, it works for any discrete subgroup of PSL2R. You have a basis of the holomorphic. So this is on the holomorphic side. Now, one of the dominant themes of Ivanovich's work is that if you look at classical analytic number theory, let's say as treated in Davenport's book, Multiplicative Number Theory, what you have there is a GL1 theory where all the characters are Dirichlet characters. And as you know, the Dirichlet characters have an orthogonality property. group orthogonality. And on that orthogonality principle is based the entire theory of the study of the distribution of primes in arithmetic progressions. So what this particular formula represents is a GL2 version of the same thing. So here you have some sort of orthogonality principle and treating the Fourier coefficients of cusp forms corresponding to an orthonormal basis as the analogs of Dirichlet characters in a two-dimensional version. And so you can then try and develop the theory that's outlined in Davenport's book in the GL1 case, and you try and carry it over to the GL2 case, which is basically the program initiated by Ivanich 25 years ago and still going strong. So-called spectral large sieve comes out of this reasoning. Okay, now coming back to this Selberg-Kosterman zeta function, Selberg proves the following theorem, which I will indicate, or I tried to indicate rather, in a rushed manner last time. So the theorem that Selberg proves is the following: ZRNS admits an analytic continuation to real part of S bigger than sigma naught if and only if the first eigenvalue of the, the sequence of eigenvalues corresponding to the non-Euclidean Laplacian is bigger than or equal to sigma naught, 1 minus sigma naught. So here is the connection between the Selberg eigenvalue problem and the determination of the abscissa of convergence of this Dirichlet series. Now, we already know something about the Plustermann sum, Weisbaum, that Plustermann sum is O of C to the half plus epsilon, gives us that the series ZRNS converges absolutely for real part of 2s minus a half bigger than 1, okay, which means that real part of s is bigger than 3/4, which implies that lambda 1 is bigger than or equal to 3/16. So this is how Selberg gets his 3/16. So he links the eigenvalue problem with the determination of the abscissa of convergence of this Klosterman-Selberg zeta function. And it's absolutely miraculous how he goes about analyzing this zeta function and in order to prove this theorem. It's beautiful harmonic analysis, absolutely stunning. Now, in the same paper, he does point out, once you establish a connection of this nature, in the same paper he points out that the Selberg eigenvalue conjecture can't hold in full generality because you don't have the appropriate estimates for the Kosterman sums and these. So from that standpoint, he concludes that the arithmeticity of the group that in question really plays a vital role in both the Ramanujan and the eigenvalue conjectures. No, no. That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that, no. Okay, so this is the general statement of things, but as I said, for the full modular case, we know that lambda 1 is bigger than 1 quarter. I'm going to show that in a second. And hence, you have the analytic continuation of the series for real part of S bigger than a half. If you see, if sigma naught is a half, you get a quarter here. Okay? So the Selberg eigenvalue conjecture that lambda 1 is bigger than a, or equal to a quarter is equivalent to saying that the abscissa of convergence of that series is a half. So Selberg's argument applies for a general discrete subgroup gamma equal to R. And for gamma arithmetic, he applies Weyl's bound for the Clostermann sums to deduce in general. Now, once you have the Gelbart-Jacquet lift, you can make this lambda 1 strictly bigger than 3 over 16. And then once you have the higher symmetric power L functions, you can have improvements of this thing. So in the subsequent lectures, I'll show how averaging of L functions leads to improved estimates for lambda 1. But for now, I will focus on Selberg's treatment of the of that zeta function. So for the remainder of this talk, I want to do two things. One, show you that in the full modular case, the second-year calculus argument allows you to deduce that lambda 1 is bigger than a quarter, and then indicate how Selberg proves his theorem. So this argument in the full modular case lambda 1 is actually very big. It's bigger than or equal to 3 over pi, 3 pi squared over 2. And this is due to Rolka. It may have been known earlier to Maas. I'll leave it to you to figure out that even though we have this improved version on lambda 1, you're not going to get a better improved version on the abscissa of convergence. The half is the cutoff point. Okay. I'll leave it to you. Think about that. So we will be extremely elementary in our argument. Proof. Let U of Z be a Maas form. Its eigenvalue lambda 1. We may also suppose that U is normalized. So without loss of generality, we may suppose that the Peterson inner product of this is 1. I'm proving that in the full modular case, lambda 1 is bigger than or equal to 3 pi squared over 2. Is that sharp? It's even bigger. Yeah, it's very big. Yeah, it's very, very big. Yeah. Well, he didn't guess it by numerical calculations. I mean, I think that 1965 paper is a beautiful paper because, you see, he analyzes it from a very general vantage point. I mean, and the final conclusions that he makes about, you have to take into consideration algebraic geometry in order to prove the thing, is arrived at not as a speculation like, you know, like some of us would do, but it's based on very deep analysis of the fact that it both these conjectures don't hold in full generality. And so, yeah. So what it means in generality, these angles are not equidistributed. The Clostermann-Sum angles, yeah. Okay. So right now I'm proving Rolke's result that lambda 1 for the full modular group is really big. If you look at, I think this has been extended by two people. One is Huxley and the other is Vinera, where they push this argument, this very elementary argument that I'm going to give now, and showed that the Selberg conjecture holds for gamma naught of Q, where Q is up to 25 or something like this. I don't know exactly what the number is. So U is a Mass form, so that means the delta, it's an eigenfunction for the Laplace operator. So, on one hand, because I've normalized my inner product to be 1, I can write lambda like this. And so this means that this is an integral over let me just write it like this. Delta U. Okay, so this is the integration over the fundamental domain. So let me refresh your memory on the shape of the fundamental domain. This is one of these proofs that should be memorized because it's one of these, or it's so clean that you more or less memorize it after you've seen it once. So the shape of the fundamental domain, the standard fundamental, you know, you can have many fundamental domains, but here's the standard one. And you know what that number is. It's root 3 over 2. Okay, just for future reference. What? Oh, it's root 3 over 2. Well, forget it. It's not there anymore, okay? Now, if you take the matrix, what happens to, so this is the standard fundamental domain. The fundamental domain that you obtain by applying S2 is this little hyperbolic triangle here. Okay, so this is F1. Now you could have computed the inner product over any fundamental domain. So therefore, 2 times lambda, so I take that one and I also apply it over, do it over F1. So 2 times lambda is the computation of the inner product over F union F1 of delta u bar dx divided by y squared. Now F union F bar is this full region, okay? And neatly enough, it contains this strip, which I will use in a second. Now, by integrating by parts, or formally known as Stokes' theorem, you can change this into an integral line. And so, as I mentioned, this region F union F1 contains this strip. So since everything is non-negative, I can integrate only over that strip. So the x is going from y is going from root 3 over 2 to infinity, and x is going from minus a half to a half. And then we will drop the other part. Why? Because remember, your Fourier expansion of a Mass form is not so clean and neat. It's not just e to the 2 pi I and z. It's got e to the 2 pi I and x and this Whitaker function, which we don't want to get bogged down on trying to compute the partial derivative of. So you write your Mass form, Fourier expansion. So writing it coefficients depending on y, e to the 2 pi I and x. So Fourier expansion at infinity. And so you do the partial derivative computation. So that the integration from minus a half to a half is, well, you take this and you take the complex conjugate and you do the integration, and you see that the orthogonality of the exponential functions leads to, well, it's Parseval's formula, a n of y squared 2 pi n squared. Okay. Therefore, from this inequality here, 2 lambda is greater than or equal to root 3 over 2 to infinity. Okay, so you do this little trick. Root 3 over 2 squared, integral root 3 over 2, infinity, understood this little trick. And then you drop this N, okay? You pull out the pi's, so that's what, 4 pi squared times 3 divided by 4, so that's 3 pi squared times root 3 over 2, infinity, summation N not 0, a n of y squared dy, dy by y squared. Is that okay with everybody? And now you introduce dx, integral over dx from minus half to half. So nothing is lost by doing that. Multiply by 1. Okay. And now this thing, I'll leave it as an exercise for you to check that when you, well, first let me make the following thing. Now that we are going from root 3 over 2 to infinity, let me just see that. This is bigger than or equal to the Peterson inner product with U itself, so 3 pi squared, which happens to be 1. Okay, so you end up getting that lambda is bigger than or equal to 3 pi squared over 2. So I'll leave you to check the details for the last part. That's basically it. And as I said, this cute argument generalizes for smaller levels. And I think Huxley and Winnerow have pushed it to the limit, as far as I can tell. Okay.
What copies of the fundamental domain you might increase the strip, but the number for which you multiply instead of 2 makes it worse?
Yes. It goes down. Like, if you want to push this argument to its ultimate, you end up getting a bound like something 1 over q squared for level q. So 3 pi squared over q squared or something like that. But I think this is carried out in one of Ivaniyach's papers. He pushes it, as you say, you know, taking several copies of the thing, and you're not going to get anything better, no. Enlarge the domain out?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think this is amazing because it's a very elementary argument, and immediately it gives you the absence of with respect to that theorem, of course, it gives you the absence of convergence of that Dirichlet series, which is not so obvious. And right. So if you were doing it for gamma naught of q, usually they do it for prime so that it's a little easier. And yeah. Q squared, it comes out roughly q squared. Yeah. So the only non-trivial step is integrating by parts. There is. It is. You see, when you do the integration by parts, there's a boundary term and it disappears. Okay. So I'll leave that as an exercise. Okay. See, all you do is you've got your, you know, d2u by du dx squared. You're gonna integrate by parts and you're gonna get u partial derivative with respect to x, other terms before you come to this term, and that other stuff disappears. Is Stokes' theorem. Okay, now let me indicate before time is up how Selberg proves the theorem that the abscissa of convergence is related to the Selberg eigenvalue conjecture. Okay, let's see. Remember, last time we introduced, the continuous versions of the discrete Poincaré series that I mentioned. So we introduced which converges absolutely real part of S Boolean 1 converges absolutely. The same proof as you would use for the Eisenstein series. Now, pardon me? It works out to the same thing. So if you just do the calculation, apply the Laplace operator plus to U and Z, you get this relation, which tells you that the UM at shifted at S plus 1 is related to UM at S, and which suggests that perhaps inductively you can analytically continue UM ZS in an inductive fashion, which is basically what Selberg does for about one page, but it's really more than one page. It's 20 pages. and the details can be found in this beautiful book by Motohashi, The Spectral Theory of the Riemann Zeta Function, so which I recommend. Don't try and take it out of the library because I just took it out. Okay, so if somebody will recall it or something. Spectral Theory. Of the Riemann Zeta Function. So the idea is some sort of, you want to invert this operator and solve for UMZS because you know this already, let's say, in the region that you're thinking, and you want to invert and then continue this in steps, which is basically what Selberg does. Having done that, the next step is to compute the inner product so this, if these are the continuous analogs of the discrete Poincaré series that I outlined before, we gained the first observation was to compute the inner product of one of these things against the cusp form, which is exactly what you would do. And you should expect to pick up the mth Fourier coefficient of the cusp form. So when you do that, so let psi j be a Mas cusp form. Then it turns out that if you compute the Peterson inner product with psi j, you end up getting AJ of N bar M where lambda j is a quarter plus rj squared is the corresponding eigenvalue. For psi j. Now, I think in the haste of last time, if you want to correct your notes, I put lambda j in there. It should have been rj with this notation. In the notes that have been posted also, I think I have lambda j there. It should be rj. I'll correct it later. Now, the Selberg eigenvalue conjecture then states that rj is real, not purely imaginary. I mean, the eigenvalues are real numbers, right? So the Selberg eigenvalue conjecture is that RJs are real and not purely imaginary. Now we're going to come up with a continuous version of this thing. So, on one hand, this is the analog of the original Peterson formula, which picks up the mth Fourier coefficient. On the other hand, now you can do the calculation of compute the Peterson inner product of two Poincaré series. And here we just plug in, as you pointed out earlier, you just plug the definitions in and interchange summations, and the unfolding of the integral leads to the Clostermann sums appearing. So by the unfolding method, we get that this equals times a messy integral, which I will write down for the sake of completeness, which is actually not so messy after all. So you get this. When you compute the inner product of two Poincaré series, you get this amazing formula with the Clostermann sums. So the zeta function, the Clostermann-Selberg zeta function that you're interested in, appears here, almost fudged up by this messy integral. And so what you do is you do the obvious. You try and determine the asymptotic behavior of the integral, stick it in. It turns out it's 1 plus some error term. So it's exactly it pulls out that particular series, so it turns out that Peterson inner product is equal to of course, none of the details are in Selberg's paper, just the answers are there. And as I say, if you want the proofs, you should look at Motohashi's book. In the full modular case, Sarnak's book on applications of modular forms carries this out in the first chapter. Gamma 2s plus 1. Plus 4 to the minus s minus 1 pi inverse n to the minus 2 gamma 2s plus 1 over gamma of s plus 2 z m n. Sorry for change in notation, but because I wrote these notes up at different times, things have changed notation, but anyway. So let's not, in the notes I'll write down what this is, okay? Let's not worry about it now because I only have 10 minutes left. Let's concentrate on the point, the main Lapointe clef, as they say, the key point on this particular formula. The inner product is essentially the Selberg-Tostermann zeta form. That's the point. That's all you need to know for the rest of the discussion. On the other hand, you know that if you have an inner product space, you have an orthonormal basis, and every function can be written as a linear combination of these orthonormal vectors. And so to compute the inner product, you have Parseval's formula, which gives you how to compute the inner product with respect to these orthonormal bases. Because that's, if things are finite dimensional, but if things are infinite dimensional, more or less something like that holds in this case. So in the case under study, these functions u, n, s, psi, j's, etc., belong to the Hilbert space L2 of the upper half plane mod gamma, functions which are invariant under gamma and which are square integrable. And so we have what's called the Selberg spectral decomposition, which says that any function can be written as a linear combination of the psi j's, an orthonormal basis of psi j's, plus a continuous part consisting of Eisenstein series, okay, which we won't worry about the Eisenstein series for now. All right. So by the Selberg spectral decomposition, I mean, this requires proof, of course, that decomposition, we may write any function f in the space as f equals summation f psi j's psi j plus some continuous part involving Eisenstein series. As I said, I'll write down the precise shape in the notes. So you have something like this, which allows you to, assuming that these psi j's are an orthonormal basis, we can compute the inner product of any two elements as essentially, so let me just put a equal up to some dot, it's essentially going to be f psi j g. And this is your Parseval's formula. In this plus other terms, Parseval's formula. So what Selberg does in his paper, as I said, without proofs again, he just writes these down. But in this context, it works. There's a continuous part with Eisenstein's theory. Okay. So now, this is just linear algebra. When you have an orthonormal basis, you can always write down the inner product with respect to the inner products of the orthonormal basis elements. So here's our expression. Here's the inner product of two of these things, which involves this Clusterman-Selberg zeta function. And so we should be able to compute the inner product using this kind of reasoning, and each of the terms will involve the Fourier coefficients of the Maas forms. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay. So, thus, let me put s bar plus 2 here, as I did. Can be written. Oops. Plus other stuff which are conveniently ignored for the moment. And each of these is really the jth Fourier coefficient of the Maas-Kuss form. And so the mess turns out to be that formula that I wrote down in a very hasty manner last time, which is that we obtain 2 pi root nm to the power 2s minus 1 summation snm C over mod C to the 2s, C going from 1 to infinity, is equal to summation J going from 1 to infinity, Aj of n, Aj of m bar, over hyperbolic cosine pi lambda j, pi rj, sine pi s over 2, which can probably be outside, times a bunch of gamma functions, s minus a half plus irj. I wrote it down there. Okay, gamma s plus a half, s minus a half plus minus irj, okay, divided by gamma of s, plus other stuff which I'm ignoring. Now, what is the Selberg eigenvalue conjecture again? It's the conjecture that RJs are real and not purely imaginary. If RJ was purely imaginary, okay, this would, these guys are going to have poles whenever the argument hits a 0 or minus 1, minus 2, and so on and so forth. Okay? And immediately you deduce the theorem that I rubbed off, the abscissa of convergence of that thing is bigger than sigma naught if and only if you have a bound for the RJs that you're supposed to have. So it's really, spectral theory of the most obvious kind. So you have this beautiful calculation with the Poincaré series giving you the Fourier coefficients, and then on the other hand, you have the Parseval formula, and it gives you the analytic continuation of the Selberg-Clusterman zeta function. And that's how Selberg proofs 3 over 16. Okay. Now, I've run out of time, but next time what I would like to point out are applications of some of this material, especially the theory of Clusterman sums, to problems in analytic number theory such as sieve theory and things like Brun-Titchmarsh theorem and divisor problems, why the analysis of the error terms in the sieve questions always, if you want to make a finer analysis instead of being satisfied with big O of 1, it will lead you into the domain of Clusterman sums. whether you like it or not. And therefore, studying mass cusp forms leads to applications in analytic number theory. So I'll do that next time.